Hello, and welcome to episode number 173 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I am your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and we have a very special guest today, Daniel Mall. He's a creative director, advisor, designer, developer, author, and entrepreneur. And that's not even talking about his abilities as a musician or his very active family life. He is the founder of Super Friendly, a design collaborative providing high-level creative services to some of the biggest brands in the world. He is the founder of, did I say co-founder? That should have been founder if I said co-founder. He is also the founder of Superbooked, a new service that helps you find work with a little help from your friends. The author of Pricing Design, a book about how to stop undercharging and overcharging, stop cheating yourself by charging hourly rates, and learn to speak confidently with your customers about the actual value your design work will deliver. And he is a speaker. In upcoming months, he'll be speaking at An Event Apart in Orlando and Washington, D.C., Smashing Conference in Toronto, Front End Conference in Zurich, and Generate Conference in New York. And I happen to know that he's deliberately cut back on touring. So that's what he's doing when he's not touring so much. Dan, welcome to the show.
Whew, that's a lot. Thanks, Jeffrey. Glad to be here.
And I've known you since you were a teenager, correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yep.
We met, you were 19, I think.
That sounds about right. Yeah, I was, I guess I had just started college at that point. So yeah, that sounds right.
And you were freelancing.
Yep.
And you came and freelanced at Happy Cog for a while, which turned into a job, which turned into a directorship. And you've just been kind of skyrocketing ever since I've known you. Where do you, you know, a lot of people plug away and don't necessarily get anywhere. What do you think has helped you carve a path for yourself that works?
Oh, man. I have a very clear answer to that, which is that I have been very, very fortunate to be surrounded by really great people that motivate me and push me, you know, from being a kid. My parents have been great and always encouraged me, my friends and family, and then all the way in through my career, meeting people like you and Jason Santa Maria, and, you know, who we both worked with, and just having people to push me all along the way and encourage me. That's been really helpful for me, is just having a good support system. And so I think that's a thing that the more people that have that in the world, I think the world is just a better place for it.
You're very active in that wish. You actually mentor, what, three people at a time?
I have five now, actually. Wow. Well, no, let me change that. Four, because today one of my apprentices starts his full-time job. So he is no longer an apprentice. He's actually a full-time designer now, as of today, his first job.
That is wonderful. Congratulations.
Yeah.
So you're talking about mentoring. You call it apprenticeship, so there may be some differences. Talk about that program, because I know it's close to your heart. What do you do, and how do you pick people and like that?
Yeah, so it's fairly informal in terms of how people, I don't know, quote unquote, apply. There's not even an application process. It's mostly the people who manage to track me down and bother me enough to make me go, wow, they seem to really want this. So I get more than a handful of applications of people, you know, sending in emails and saying, hey, I'd like to be part of this, and then I don't hear from them again. And I, like you mentioned, I like to do a lot of different things, and so I don't often get back to people. And so the ones that are just kind of persistent, you know, the ones that are, they'll come and find me at events that I'm speaking at and make sure that they're not taking up too much of my time and things like that. You know, that's how most apprentices find me. And then the rest is word of mouth. So it's usually an apprentice that has come in and done an apprenticeship with me, recommends a friend or a former coworker from a past life or something like that, or a nephew that's like, hey, my nephew is not going to go to college or doesn't think college is the right thing for him, you know, but he wants to learn design or wants to learn development. Can he talk to you? And usually kind of blossoms from there.
Are they all in Philadelphia?
They are. Yeah. I haven't quite figured out how to do remote apprenticeship or distributed apprenticeship, or, you know, just not being in the same location, I find that that's really difficult, because a lot of the learning is sort of passive learning. So, like, as an example, I spend a lot of time doing all my phone calls in the open. So I don't have an office. I don't have like a room that I go and do sales calls in. I just do them on speakerphone so that my apprentices can hear what it's like to be on a sales call, or when I present design or present something to a client, I do that all in the open, because that was one of the things that helped me when I was learning, was, you know, just watching people do it and going, absolutely, oh, I can do that. So I try to do it open like that. And that's hard to do when you're remote, because then all the learning has to be active, right? It has to be like, hey, let's get on a call so that you can observe this one thing. And it's less so like I'm doing a thing and people can just wander over, or you know, kind of peek over my shoulder of something I'm doing.
Have you ever had negative you show up at a, you know, you work with some very big clients. Have you ever shown up with, you know, a lot of people dressed in very expensive suits, and you've got three or four or even five youngish adults with you, mm-hmm, just as part of your crew? Have you ever had any negative pushback, like, don't have them here, or who are these people? I thought we were going to discuss something very private. I mean...
Never. And, wow. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is because I never spring that on them, right? So it's never like, right, I'll just show up with a bunch of people. So usually I'll say way early on when I'm talking to a client, usually in the sales process, hey, I run an apprenticeship. Part of probably what will be part of this project is I will have an apprentice or two on this project so that they can learn how to do this stuff. And what I find is that there's certainly never pushback, but there's also the other direction. People are very encouraged by that, because I think for a lot of clients that we work with, they don't know this job. They don't know design or development. Their job is not design or development. Their job, right, is whatever, publishing or marketing or whatever it is. And I think having somebody on the project that the whole point of them being there is to learn kind of gives the client permission to learn alongside. So rather than the client going like, oh, no, I have to pretend like I know this job, it's open. The environment is such that somebody is there to learn. So the client feels – I find that they feel a lot more comfortable going – well, what is PHP, or what do you mean by CMS, or, you know, I mean, maybe not that elementary, but they feel more welcome because somebody else is asking those kind of questions, so they feel welcome to ask those kind of questions too.
Or if they were very self-conscious, they could always do the thing where they pretend that it's that it's the other. You know, Sally looks a little confused. Maybe you could explain for Sally's benefit what a CMS is.
Exactly.
Huh. Yep. Is there any kind of qualification in terms of economic background or anything like that? Are you looking for particular types of people, like underrepresented groups, anything like that? Or
I didn't start that way. So the way that it started was with my brother-in-law, because my brother-in-law was, you know, he's had all these odd jobs every summer, and he was just like, look, I want to get married. I want to move out of my mom's house. I want to get a job. And so it started there. But since then, so he was the first apprentice that I had, and that was, 2012 or 2013. And since then I've had, I think, 14 or 15, something like that. And I would say the majority of those 15 people have either been people of color or women. And I think that I'm more and more encouraged to do that, you know, to really have something that focuses on people of color and women, because our industry is just so underrepresented in those areas. And so, you know, myself being a person of color, it's a thing that I think I have the ability to do in ways that maybe a 30-something-year-old white person cannot do, or white male cannot do. And so I feel like that's a thing that I can do. So I'm encouraged to kind of continue doing that.
Absolutely. I think that makes a lot of sense. Also, you're one of the good guys. I think women, how can I put this? Sometimes when a man appears to be offering mentoring, often, too often, and not just in our business, in fact, less maybe in our business, but enough. A lot of times when men are trying to help women in their careers, there's this, you know, nasty ulterior motive, which clearly would not be the case with you. And that's a good thing too.
Yeah. I mean, it's such an unfortunate thing that happens. And I wish that people were better about that. You know, I try to be as helpful as I can. And I try to be as conservative as I can about, you know, making sure that my intentions are clear, you know, whoever I'm working with, and that trying to have those kinds of intentions up front and those conversations up front, I think hopefully would give the potential apprentice a good sense of what they would be getting into, as well as me. And you know, I'm not forced to do this. I'm also, you know, I'm pretty choosy in the apprentices that I do pick. I don't have a lot of time to say take on a cohort of 50 people. And so, you know, I want to make sure that it's beneficial both ways. It's something that I can get something out of by scratching the itch of being able to teach and mentor, as well as the potential apprentice too, is that they get something out of it as well.
Typically, how much background should an apprentice have? Can you work with someone who's just interested but has no experience at all?
I almost exclusively work with someone who has, who is just interested and has no experience at all. And the reason for that is because my apprenticeship is designed to be really basic. It's designed for someone to be able to get an entry-level job in design or development. And so I get a lot of people that say, hey, I'm really interested. I would love some mentorship. And, you know, here's my portfolio and here's a couple of things I put together and I built a WordPress site and I did this. And I often tell those people, like, well, you're overqualified for my apprenticeship, because the end of my apprenticeship that I do, it's a 9-month apprenticeship. And at the end, the point is you can put together a portfolio. So if you already are, if you're coming in and having had put together a portfolio already, then you don't need this apprenticeship, right? What you could probably do, and this is the advice that I tend to give, is if you're willing to spend 9 months with me unpaid, because I don't promise to pay anybody. I just say, you know, it's half and half. It's like, I'll teach you stuff. So it's kind of like school, but it's also a job. And so we kind of break even there. I don't pay you, but you don't have to pay me. You know, just come and show up and do the work.
Right.
So part of the thing that if somebody who has a portfolio already, I say, well, if you're willing to spend nine months with me for free, why don't you go and volunteer at your local agency and say, hey, I'll do work for you for free for a month if you promise to evaluate my work after a month and consider me for a full-time position. Like, that's more worth the effort for that person rather than, you know, spending time with me. I think a lot of people think that the apprenticeship is a bit of a magic bullet where they go, if I spend the time in the apprenticeship, then I'm guaranteed to get a job. And that's not true at all.
Wow, that's very interesting. You know, you inspired me. I've always informally mentored anyone who was interested that I've worked with. And I teach, and, you know, my students can always come to me even, you know, from prior years and just check in and talk about their careers or their worries or whatever. But I reached out to someone I knew just through, just through a social connection, basically. And it's an older gentleman. I feel like at my age, you know, this is someone who, let's say they're in their late 30s. By when I say older gentleman, I don't mean he's 90. I mean somebody in their late 30s, early 40s, mm-hmm. Who's in a big career transition, which is something that I'm pretty experienced with because I've gone through several of them. In fact, I feel like I'm in a perpetual one in this business in a strange way. But and I'm able to help. And I thought about you and what you do, and I thought this is kind of a perfect opportunity for me. So I want to thank you for the inspiration and, you know, just being a power of example in terms of paying it forward, helping other people. I think it's great. I think I also know that service is a great way to get outside yourself. Yep. And I have less time to be anxious about how's my business doing.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't mean I don't worry when I need to worry and don't work. I work, but I mean I have less time to just sit and bite my nails because I'm helping others.
Yep, so I totally agree.
I think that's a powerful thing for anybody who's trying to really achieve something. Now, you wrote a book, Pricing Design. I was very happy that our little company, A Book Apart, published it. Thank you for that. Talk a little bit about, for someone who hasn't read it, you're sitting next to someone on a plane. You're sitting next to a designer, developer, web person, design person on a plane, and they ask, what's your book about? What's your 2-minute explanation and why it matters?
It's about making more money. Because you're selling people things that they actually want, and you're taking the time to focus on learning about what they want so that you can sell it to them in a non-skeezy way. So that's sort of my elevator pitch for it.
You do value pricing.
Yeah, that's right.
And how that works is you sort of look at what the return on investment might be. Do you sort of put your money where design's mouth is in a way? Maybe like basically say, this isn't an expense coming out of it, but people look at design like, oh gosh, I don't want to spend $X thousand on design. Saying, yep. You know, and you don't want to spend it on dentist on dental work either, but if you don't do that, your mouth will get worse and you'll get sick and nobody will kiss you. So it's like that. It's like,
yeah,
the benefit of hiring. You call yourself a creative director these days, which of course you are, but why, how did you come on that? Of all the things you do, how did you come on that as the thing that best, to the extent you can, that best summarizes what you do?
So one thing I should say is that I change that title depending on who I talk to. So okay. Some people know what that means and some people don't know what that means. And so for people like us, if I say creative director to you, you know that's shorthand for something that I think you would understand. If I was sitting next to someone on a plane, I wouldn't say I was a creative director. I would say I run a design company, even though because that's a shorthand for, okay, I kind of get what you do. And then it gives me an entryway to explain that. So creative direction to me is the reason that I say that with people like us and people that know what we do is that I find that the term designer it describes what I used to do and be good at and be best at, and it's no longer that. What I find that I'm better at is working with designers to help unlock them in the stuff that they do. I'm designing on a handful of projects right now, and every time I do it, I'm like, I like this and I miss doing this, but this is a mistake for me to be doing this because I work with so many people that are just better at it, and I'm better at going, what if you tried this? And what if you tried this? And let me show you this thing. And let me expose you to a couple of other sources and kind of helping their curiosity, which is a thing that when I worked with creative directors that they did for me. And now I'm realizing, oh, I'm doing that for other people. So that more accurately represents, at least to me, what I'm doing and what I enjoy doing more. And so a little bit of it is more accurately reflecting my current state, but it's also a little bit of me kind of dressing for the job that I want. That's what I want to be doing more and more of. So I have to say that. I have to kind of declare that into existence and then go, all right, well, if I call myself this, I should actually be doing that thing.
I mean, I was told when I was in advertising, Marvin Honig hired me. He was the guy who made this, you won't remember this, but he made the spicy meatball commercial for Alka-Seltzer. They're basically, it's a video shoot. It's like behind the scenes at a video shoot. They're shooting a commercial about spicy meatball, and the guy, and it's very ethnically cast. And the guy's going, "That was some spicy meatball," and they keep giving it to him because they're not getting the take right. So he has to keep eating the spicy food. And it was just like that was the demo. That was the setup for Alka-Seltzer, which relieves the. It was a big award-winning commercial in, I guess, the 70s. He hired me, so he's a legend.
Okay.
And he said to me, if you're not a creative director by the time you're 40, you should not be in the business. And that made sense to me. And I, you know, in the beginning of my design career, I was really interested in craft details, design trends, and how do I reproduce this effect in Photoshop, and how do I do this in CSS, all that stuff. And that stuff really matters. And to be good at the design aspect, I think you have to be kind of obsessed with that those crazy levels of detail. And then I think after some, and it's not about age, like it's not biological age, chronological age, it's just sort of age in a business. At a certain point, for some people, and I'm one of those people, you sort of migrate out of that role into more of a big picture-y role about, you know, what should this be trying to achieve? How should people who use this feel? And you can recognize when someone's on the right track and go, that's fantastic. And then you're right. Everybody I work with is a million times better than me now. And it's, you know, it's sad when I try to design. I'm always frustrated and hating it. You know,
yeah, same here.
once in a great while, I do something that I kind of like, and then I'm in awe of it and think I'm a genius, and then I'm very sick of it right away. So,
yeah, I have the same thing. I think that part of being a good designer, I think part of what being a good designer, this is what I try to teach my apprentices, but also at least my own experience is that good designers are curious people, and they're often kind of like uncovering things of like things that they didn't do yet or things that they haven't explored before. That's one of the things I love about client service. And the reason that I've never worked in-house anywhere is because I like, you know, every 3 months or 6 months or 9 months or a year or however long, you know, just jumping from client to client and going, now I'll learn about marine biology. Now
learn
I'll
learn things.
About textbook sales.
Right.
Now I'll learn about, you know, whatever those things are. And I think that, you know, I've just designed enough websites in my career that I'm no longer curious about it anymore. So I'm like, I just like being in Photoshop or Sketch or Studio or whatever the tools are that everybody uses now. It's like, I've done that enough. I'm no longer curious about it. And so I'm less inspired. And so I don't do good work there anymore. And what is curious to me is going, well, how do I put teams together? And how do I, you know, how do I sell this client on a particular concept? Or, you know, what are the right words to use here? Like, I'll write as much copy now as I will push pixels, yeah. You know, because I'm more curious about that and going, well, how do these things fit together? So I'm mostly just trying to follow my curiosity, and it's just no longer in pushing pixels. So it's not to condemn it or say that it's bad. I've done enough of it that I'm like just doing the boring stuff now.
Some people, just to be clear, some people, their whole career, they're graphic designers, and they just get better and better and deeper and deeper because it's a mystery too. And the other thing about being unsatisfied, I mean, to me, design is this, it's mostly, you can get to pretty good pretty quickly. Almost anybody can get to pretty good pretty quickly. And then there's this, it's like this 2% difference that makes all the difference that takes four times as long as the first part. It's really easy to bang stuff out. And especially we have, like you said, so many tools now. It's almost like I know what kind of site this is. I'll pour this content into that, and I'll pick the best photos my client has, and I'll color tint them in this ideal world so that everything matches in a way it never really will in real life. Because I mean, I used to make Photoshop droplets to control the color and the focus so that the client would be as obsessive as I was, and like, so the tints would match and everything would have sort of a nice art directed feel to it, which they never did. They never do.
Right.
They had no interest it because it didn't matter to them.
Right.
It's, you know, I mean, there's a reason, like movies that we love, that, you know, you look at the cinematography and the color scheme and, like, everything's considered, right? But, and you want your websites to be that way, but they're not going to be. So, and I have you found migrating more to design systems to be a partial solution to that problem, or?
As an entryway, yes. So, like, one of the things that I often start with design systems is, you know, our mutual friend Josh Clark. He has this great post that he wrote that called "The Most Exciting Design Systems Are Boring," and I love it. He talks about how, like, let your design system, at least when you start out, if you don't have one and you're starting to create one, don't try to solve every problem with your design system. Just let it take care of the boring stuff. Let it take care of the buttons and the forms and the dropdowns and all the stuff that you just don't want to design again in Sketch or in Photoshop or wherever. Just all the stuff that you're just like, I don't care to be doing that stuff. I think maybe, you know, kind of tying back to what we were just talking about, like the stuff that you're not curious about anymore. Like, how many times do you want to design that button anymore?
The production work.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
Used to be a big part of... when I was starting that, because we didn't have CMS systems, that
right,
was a
exactly.
big part of your income. They'd be like, we changed, you know, and you couldn't use CSS, didn't exist. You couldn't just use HTML for the button because the client felt ripped off. I thought you were a designer. So you'd make these little Photoshop buttons, and then they'd say, we've changed the navigation label. Cause of course they do. Cause they're a client. They're always changing everything. And you'd be like, you'd make so much money just tediously, but it always felt like this is the wrong way to do things. I mean, in a way, CSS was the first pointer to a design system philosophy, right?
Absolutely.
It's like saying, set the type of each paragraph, set a paragraph, and then paragraphs will always have the same design unless they're a different kind of paragraph, and then label it and make that other design style. But
all the stuff that you were just talking about in, you know, creating Photoshop droplets and actions and things like that. Well, great. We can automate that in a different way now, and we can automate it actually smarter and faster. So let's do that. Let's make Grunt build all that stuff. Let's make, you know, our build packages optimize the images for us and tint them on the server, you know, for whatever size we need to output. Like the machines are good enough at doing that kind of stuff so that we can focus on the actual problems. We can focus on the things that go, all right, now that we don't have to spend weeks and weeks doing, you know, doing that crop dropping images, right? Now that we can write actions and have build tools do that, what are we freed up to do now? So but whenever I'm working with a client that has like a hesitancy around design systems, where they go, you know, a lot of designers have a worry when they go, if we have a design system, what's my job? And I always start with, well, what is the thing that you wish you had time for? And it's always, oh, illustration style or animation or look and feel or art direction or creative direction, like all of those things that just never have time for. Well, great. Now you have time for them. So now they have time for them. Now, how do you solve those problems? And I find that tends to be the thing that turns the light bulb on to go, oh, yeah, you're right. Now I do have time for that stuff.
We are the same person. Just like when we were pushing for web standards back in the day, people would say, do you know how much money I make knowing the four different ways to make the same? We'd be like, you're making the same crappy website. You're making an IE3 version, an IE4 version, a Netscape 3 version, a Netscape 4 version. Then you're done. You spend all the client's money. And they're like, do you know how much money I make doing that? And I'm like, yeah, how about hiring a writer with that money? Or how about spending the time researching photos? Spend the client's money on that. Spend the client's money on art direction. How about that? So it's the same thing. We always fall in love with these sort of difficulties.
Yep.
And make them virtual. Although I have to say, I miss cropping things. I miss, like, I really miss that kind of, you know, again, like that detail obsessed, I want the exact right photo and I don't want the machine to guess. I mean, machines do great jobs at guessing. Now, I use Swarm, as I think you do too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And if I take three photos and two of them are square and one of them's wide, Swarm will put the wide one on the top and the two square ones underneath next to each other. It will do what an art director would do. And if I make three that are all wide, Swarm will decide which should be square. It'll find, and it'll change sometimes. You'll see recropping, right? If you have a slow enough connection, you'll actually see Swarm going, you know what? That other picture of the cat, really, you know, that's the one that should be. I'm going to recenter that. And I'm going like, okay, it does what I would do. And it does it really fast. So, yeah. Well, I think there is a danger if you're only specializing in the kinds of things that machines can do, you might be in danger of losing a job. My dad worked in automation, right? Again, in the 70s, worked on robotics and things like that as an engineer. And sometimes he would hear from people, oh, you're going to put people out of jobs. And he would say, but, you know, the steam shovel put people out of jobs with spades, right? Before that, if you wanted to dig a big hole in the ground, you had to use little shovels. And yes, that job's gone now. This machine can do it. But that means those people could go to college or go to a trade school and learn something else to do. I think there's almost a reaction against learning right now in our culture, at least in some places, so that, like, people are really angry about coal going away. And I get that. I get a way of life going away is a terrible thing. And a job that you know how to do going away is a terrible thing. But it's also an opportunity, and with the right programs in place. I mean, I remember reading a year ago about these coal miners who became web developers. And I don't know that that's for every coal miner, but I thought, like,
right.
But that's the kind of thing that should be happening.
Yes.
You can't go, oh, we can't have indoor plumbing because I'm an outhouse cleaner. It's like at some point, human life is getting less painful and less dirty and less ugly. And people shouldn't be getting tuberculosis at 20 because they're down in a coal mine. And that person maybe can write or become a scientist or have just a trade job that's, you know, more skill, less pain. I don't know. That seems odd. It feels like it's an easy populist win to talk about the past as if you can go back to it. But I don't think the past has been the source of human happiness. I think progress has been a source of human happiness. I mean, some things, right, there's some spiritual things that never change, and family is great and all that. But in terms of what you do for a living, like an 8-hour work week is better than a 12. I'm sorry, 8-hour work day is better than a 12 or 16-hour work day. Children in school is better than child labor. Like,
yep.
Progress, you know.
Yep. This is one of the things I'm so grateful to have learned from this industry, which is just the embracing unfamiliarity. Like there's something, you know, if you're so tied to a technology, for example, a really minuscule example, if you're tied to a technology like Flash, for example, it's going to be obsolete someday. And so if you're so tied to it, like you go down with the ship. And so part of what I think people in this industry have to embrace in order to thrive is the fact that you just embrace the unfamiliarity. And that's the thing that I spend a lot of time with my apprentices on. It's just like, you know, they all come in with the model that you learn in school, which is first you learn how to do all of the thing and then you go and do the thing. And that's just not a model that works in our industry because things change so much. So if you can get comfortable with the idea that, oh, this is uncomfortable and I don't know it, but through the course of doing it, I will learn it. You know, that's, it's flipped from the model of education in that, you know, you learn all of it first and then you go and do that thing. And I think that's the same thing that you're talking about in that, you know, people are so tied to their way of life and then they go, well, I don't know what's around the corner. And if I have to learn something new, there's a chance that I would fail. You know, failure, at least in our industry, you know, we could treat it relatively and go, well, you know, what does failure mean? I launched a typo on the site. All right, well, great. I can just log in and fix it. You know, I can just change it. It's easy. I can change it. And the fact that our industry and the work that we do is often, you know, not all the time, but often pliable and moldable. And, you know, we launch something. Well, great. We can change it. The next day we can just upload a new version and it'll be, you know, and people will forget about it. They'll cry about it and then they'll forget about it.
Right. Especially if you work in-house or if you have the right kind of relationship with your client,
yep.
The client can say, I just lost $10,000 because of this thing you did. And you can say, let's go, we're going to fix that. Good. We've learned
let's
something.
Let's go make it back. Exactly. Wait,
let's make it back. Let's make double that back. It'll be okay. Yep. I mean, the scary meetings are less scary than they would be if you just printed the encyclopedia and it had typos in it. You'd be like, yeah, and we've just shipped 100,000 of them, right?
Exactly, that we have to go burn now.
Or we've made this car and the brakes don't work. If you make a website and the brakes don't work, you can, you know, you're going to have a bad weekend, but you can fix it.
Yep.
We're going to talk about so much more. I want to talk about super friendly, super booked, about work and life and
like I
have heard you pretty much don't answer email on the weekend so you can be with your family. We're gonna talk about all that kind of stuff, but I have to thank our sponsor first. Can you hang in there for a second?
Yeah, please do it.
All right. And our show today is sponsored by Squarespace, and here are some things you can do with Squarespace. You can create a beautiful website to turn your cool idea into a new website, showcase your work, blog, publish content, sell products and services of all kinds, promote your physical or online business, announce an upcoming event or special project, and more. Squarespace does this by giving you really, really beautiful templates. These templates were created by some of them were created by people we know who are among the best designers in the industry. There's powerful e-commerce functionality built in that lets you sell anything online. And you can customize the look and feel, the settings, products, and more with just a few clicks. Even if you're a skilled designer developer and you just want to work quickly, you get these templates that start out beautiful and logical and designed to achieve certain things that are kind of standard, right? And then you can take them and evolve them to be the brand that you want and the message you want. Everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box. And you can even buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions. They have analytics to help you grow in real time, built-in search engine optimization, free secure hosting, and there's nothing to patch or upgrade ever. They do that for you. And there's 24/7 award-winning customer support. So if you're ever stuck, you get unstuck real fast by talking to a person. Squarespace is encouraging folks to make it. Easily make a website by yourself and then make it stand out by making a beautiful website. So if you're at all intrigued by this, and why wouldn't you be? If you have clients or would-be clients who can't afford your services but need a fantastic website and need it quickly, if you have a desire to customize your design business by optimizing an existing product that's really good and sort of branding it for your specific clients, you're just curious and want to check out Squarespace, go to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code BIGWEBSHOW to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Again, go to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code BIGWEBSHOW to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Thank you, Squarespace. And now we are back on episode 173 of the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. We are talking about with Dan Moll, designer, developer, advisor, author, entrepreneur, creative director, keyboardist, and maker of Grunt Doing It. He is a guy that makes Grunt do it, and he's okay with that. Early in your career, when we were working together, one of the things that really impressed me about you was your willingness to bridge divides. The one I'm thinking of in particular was the divide between Flash, which you just mentioned a moment ago, and standards. At the time, most people were either completely in the web standards boat, leave me alone, I'm learning CSS, yep, or they were completely in the Flash boat, Flash will never die, I can do so much great art direction with Flash, I can do so much great animation, this is how the web should be, I really don't want to do your stupid, learn your stupid floats. Look, I'm animating stuff. Leave me alone. And you were like, I'm going to use the tool that best does the job. And, you know, and I don't, again, you were like 20 at the time, which I was really impressed by that. I remember saying to people, this guy's in both worlds and he's happy and he's good at both. You even wrote an article way back in the day for A List Apart about, you know, it was okay to love standards and use Flash. And you worked on the, what was that? Before we had web fonts. What was it? You worked on Cipher.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Helped create Cipher, or you made an adjustment to Cipher? What was the thing that you did?
Yeah, so there was two things. So Sean Inman made Cipher, which was scalable Inman Flash replacement, where he took where he would create Flash text box, which had fonts embedded in it, and then passed in the HTML text as a variable. And then I did a variation of that called Swiffer, which was take images and pass them into Flash before CSS supported
background
corners and rotation and things like that. So passing the image into Flash as a variable to say, all right, let's rotate it dynamically, or let's put rounded corners on it, or let's put a border or a fancy frame on it in using Flash. So basically, like, because Flash could do all these things that the web browsers didn't support yet, and so it's essentially it was just a polyfill for a while until we got things like web fonts and border radius and rotation and all that stuff, and then we didn't need it anymore.
It was more than a polyfill; it was a pointer to the kind of web we wanted to have.
Yeah, that's
with
right.
Standards. It's like, I think everyone would have. I mean, I was kind of purist about standards myself, and so I was like, no, I'm going to do without all those things, and I'm going to tell my client they're wrong to want them. Like, I was kind of like a scold. No, I can't give you a round corner, and here's why, right? Or like I could have, but with like 7,000 divs, and I was like, no, that's silly, here's why. And I would find the clients that would agree. They would go, yeah, I guess if it loads faster and works everywhere, that is better. But there were lots of clients who were like, what are you even talking about? I just wanted to do this cool thing that my competitor site's doing. Anyway, I think those innovations, there's a ton of innovation right now. There's a ton of capabilities on the web right now. But I miss those sort of primitive days of those big ideas like that. Like, I'm going to combine Flash and JavaScript to let browsers do something they can't do, so that you can still write HTML. You can even write accessible semantic HTML, and people will still be able to use it even if they don't see this particular feature. But it was forward looking. It would say if someday we can do this in CSS, great. But right now, who cares? Let's just do this.
And, yeah, I mean, I think that's what the plugin architecture is for. I mean, kudos to all the people who said early on in the technologies, okay, we're going to have a plugin architecture so that we can do stuff like this, you know, where the stuff that we can't do in the browser yet for whatever reason, because browser makers aren't on board or because the specifications aren't worked out yet.
Right.
You know, that's what plugins are for. So Flash was great for that, to go, all right, let's do this in the plugin. And then eventually, if people, the famous saying in our industry is, we pave the cow paths. Okay. If everybody wants to do this and everybody's finding ways to do this, now let's bake it in as a standard. And, you know, and then we don't need the plugin anymore. We don't need the polyfill anymore. You know, and so I feel like, you know, Canvas is a little bit like that now too, where let's see what people do with Canvas. You know, it's not native to the web, right? And there are downsides to using it, you know, accessibility and all sorts of stuff like that. But let's use it as a test bed and go, well, what are people actually wanting to do with this? And here's a way to do it temporarily. And then let's see, let's pave the cow path. Then let's build stuff in, like, you know, like I don't even know what, but processing or you know, whatever, particle generation or whatever people end up wanting to do with that stuff, eventually that can become a standard. But it's hard to know what to create as a standard before people start going, well, we want this and we're going to try to do it.
Well, but Canvas itself is a standard, right?
Oh yeah, that's true. That's a bad
example.
It's
a standard. And VR, there's a W3C authored standard for VR. So nowadays people, I think the logjam of the old days broke. In the early days, yeah, HTML right. was just very basic. So JavaScript was invented to let it do stuff. And before CSS, right, there were plugins to let it do stuff. And nobody really wanted the simple language to be more complicated than what it was. Right. But now that, I think now everything start, you know, we've got very hip people working on standards.
Yes,
right.
This is true. Yep.
And not that they weren't back then. Man, I'm going to get in so much trouble now. They were.
No, they weren't. They were just fewer. You know, they were just less people. It was you and nine other people.
There were fewer designers.
Right.
There were fewer designers involved with standards. I'm not even talking about me and the web standards project. I'm talking about the people that actually made like CSS 2.1.
Right.
Right. In the beginning, these standards weren't being done by designers. Jeff Veen was the only design person on the only design invited expert with an actual design practice and background that I know of that was working on the actual standards at the time. Right? It was mostly scientists.
Yeah, that's right.
Which was cool. I found. Well, I think a lot of what I do in client services is translate between people, and that's also what I do as a creative director in some degree. And I think with web standards, that's what I'd do too. I'd have this really nerdy conversation I could barely follow with someone like Tantek Celik, who's a genius.
Yes.
And then I would go, but here's what, and then I would sort of talk to this very bright designer and say, here's what you could do. Because nobody was making that connection, right? Here's why. Here's what you could do. The scientists knew why, but they weren't selling, right?
Yep.
They were just inventing. So it needed somebody to sort of walk behind them. And they needed a P.T. Barnum. Like, I was glad to do that. They needed somebody to go, and these elephants can stand on their hind legs. You should come check it out. Your kids will love it. Which
yep,
is a
totally.
Bad example because animal abuse in
yes.
circuses. But what can I say? It's 9:43. I've only had one cup of coffee, so... Yeah, so let's talk about your latest company or your latest
sure.
thing, Superbooked. What is it? How does it work?
So Superbooked is there's a couple things. So one is Superbooked is an experiment for me to see if I can build a product with a couple of friends. The other thing is it scratches an itch for me too, in that the way that I have gotten most of my work over the years, and I imagine you probably have a similar story, is that is word of mouth. You know, it's not SEO. You know, it's not Google at good AdWord placement. It's trying to do good work and then spreading the word about that work via a stage or a podcast or writing or a blog or, you know, all of those things. And then people going, hey, we saw this piece of work that you did and we'd love to work with you because we'd like something similar. And then the thing that I'm finding more and more now is that the people who are referring work are not just someone who works in-house, but someone that I've maybe worked with in the past. So that could be somebody that I worked at an agency, or that could be somebody who does something that I do. So as an example, you know, there are designers that work in-house. And this is a thing that I learned very early on in my career working at HappyCog, was like, somebody would go and read your book, and they would be in-house somewhere, and whenever their CMO would say, hey, we need to bring somebody in to redesign our website, they would go, hey, I read this great book. We have to bring these people in. And that's where HappyCloud would come in and do that work. And so that's something that I saw as a model early on, and that has continued to happen in my whole career. And so Superbooked is a service that is supposed to help facilitate that even more, is to go, let me connect with all my friends in a place where it's specifically designed to go, hey, I heard about this thing. I know who would be really great for this is that person over there, and be able to kind of send work to that person and facilitate that. So it's early in its infancy. My co-founder and I are trying to figure out how to do it, how to work with it, how to bootstrap it, how to make it good for the people that are using it. So it's early, but we're hopeful that it could turn into something really good.
Why am I not doing this already?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've been doing this manually, and so I wanted to build a thing that helped automate it a little bit more, and just slowly been trickling out to some friends. So if you're interested, happy to send you an invitation.
Yeah, I can just start my 30-day free trial. That's the other thing I can do.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Why don't I do that? Well, you know what? I just did that. And I will start my free trial, and
there you go.
Booked. You're already you're using MailChimp.
Yes, that's right.
To let me know.
Yep, so, that's right.
Very nice. Okay, here's the real question, Dan Mall. First of all, Dan Mall or Daniel Mall?
Daniel is my full name, but I go by Dan. When I was in elementary school, there were four of us, so there was a Dan, Danny, Daniel, and then I was Daniel Mall. So when I went to a new high school, I was like, I'm going to be Dan. And so I've been Dan ever since high school.
Because when I go to danielmall.com, which was always your website,
yep,
that no longer exists, or if it does, it's somewhere else.
Yes.
And I get redirected to danmall.me.
Yeah, and honestly, the reason for that is because when I first signed up for When I first bought a domain, danmall.com was taken, and I think it still is taken. So I went with danielmall.com, and then when I went to then I signed up for Twitter, and then I was like, well, my Twitter handle should be the same as my URL, so it was Daniel Mall on Twitter, and then I became known as Daniel in this field.
Did you ever feel like I better just go with it because it, you know, I never know from one place to the next which one you're going to be.
Yeah, I know. I'm okay with both. I'm not offended either way, but I don't know.
Dan Mall.
Dan saves you a syllable.
Dan Mall. It saves you a syllable. So Dan Mall, and why .me as your professional domain out of all the possible domains?
Because that's what I could get. That's what was available, honestly.
So Dan, you can't get danmall.com.
Yeah, not yet.
What about danmall.design, or would that be too limiting?
Yeah, I don't know. I probably have it.
Yeah, you probably have it, and it redirects to this.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, let's see. I have it too. In fact, I was talking to some folks who sell domains, and they had the .design domain. And I said, oh, Studio Zeldman should really get that. And I was talking to them, and we had this long. And they said, you know you have it, right?
Nice.
I'd forgotten, and it redirects. So I hadn't didn't even go. Think about it. But so if someone typed like Zeldman.design or whatever, I don't remember, it would just go to the right place. Huh.
So easy to spend so much money on all those, though.
The Chris Matthews that you have writing your test, yeah, but it's fun.
Yeah, that's true.
Here's the thing. There's two kinds of money. There's the money that's like coming out of your child's education. That's real money. And then there's a client budget that has some flexibility in it.
Right.
And yeah.
That's your domain money.
That's your domain money. That's what I'm saying. If you do your job well and you don't need to cover overages.
Right.
If you estimated well and the job comes in for what it should come in, and you have a little extra,
then you go buy danmall.church.
Domain money. When you look at your friends who, you're gifted in many areas, and when you look at your friends, mutual friends who become millionaires, billionaires, making kind of mass appeal products, do you ever think, I'm going to get out of client services and just try making a, you know, I'm going to make the next Instagram or whatever. Do you ever think about that?
All the time.
Okay.
Almost daily.
Really?
Yes. Yes. The grass is just always greener for me. But okay. I'm also, so it's weird. I'm like, I've always been ambitious and I've always been curious and going, oh, I want to try that and I want to try that and I want that to be the thing. But I've also, I think this comes from my dad. I've also been very content at the same time. So like, I'm a pretty content person. Yes. I'm not, you know, it's a weird balance of being content and ambitious at the same time. So I can look at a bunch of stuff and go, ooh, I want to do that. I want to do that. I want to do that. But I'm also okay if I don't do those things. So it actually, I find that skill really helps me because it makes me adventurous, but it also makes me like really risk tolerant too and loss tolerant.
Hmm. What would you need to be able to try that? Where would your life have to be for you to?
That's a good question. This is funny. I interviewed at Facebook in 2008, I think, something like that. And I went out there and I interviewed and I got an offer from them and I turned it down because I wanted to move to New York instead with my wife, who she and I had just gotten married at the time. So we decided to move to New York instead of San Francisco. It was a hard choice for us. And last year, I think, I was listening to a podcast. I was listening to How to Start a Startup by Sam Altman from Y Combinator. And he had this example and he said, you know, the podcast was about why founders always want to start their own thing, you know, because they own 100% of their thing as opposed to going to join a Google or a Facebook where they own 0.0001% of this thing. And he's like, well, let me make the case for why that's actually more lucrative for you than owning 100% of your dinky startup. And so he said, well, imagine you had worked at Facebook and you started there in, say, 2008. So I go, oh, my ears perk up. Oh, that could have been me. And he's like, so given where Facebook is right now, you probably would have been worth something like $20 million now. And I was like, oh, I was driving in the car. I like pulled
That's
over.
Crazy. Beside.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, man, because my wife and I, when we turned it down, you know, it was sort of like, well, maybe we could make a, you know, a million or two there. Because who knows at that point, you know, you don't know if Facebook's going to IPO or survive or thrive or what. So we were like, well, you know, OK, maybe so we're turning down a good chunk of money. But, you know, maybe we can make it up somewhere else, or maybe we'll just be happier doing something else. And then when I heard 20 million on this podcast, I was like, oh, gosh, like my knees got all weak. I was like, oh, boy. And so I called her on the phone and I was like, guess what I just heard? And she's like, that is crazy. And she's like, but we probably would not have been married. It's like, well, that's true. That, I, you know, you which wouldn't is not have, to say.
You were already married.
We were married, but I think, but part of what I had,
it would have hurt the relationship.
It totally would have. Cause what she said was, if you take this job, we'd have to commit to like not seeing each other for a year or two while you're working, while you're making that money. And then we can go and do whatever we want afterwards. And I was like, I don't want to do that for our first couple of years of marriage. Just not be with each other a lot.
If you moved, she couldn't have moved.
I think she would have and could have, but it was just like, I would have been at work all the time.
Right.
Know? Yeah, Facebook is Facebook. They, you know, and that's no condemnation against the people that work there, but they have things there that are designed for you to not leave. You know?
Yes. So what I was going to say is, I mean, you've had the life that you've wanted, and you can't put a price on that.
Absolutely, and that's why, to me, like, so to your question about like what would have to exist in my life to try that, I don't know, because I don't know that there's a lot that I really want that I'm like, I would sacrifice a lot to have that. You know, I work a reasonable schedule. I get to see my wife and my kids a lot. I want to see them more than I do now, but I get to enjoy the work that I do with my clients and the apprenticeships and all that stuff. So I've got it pretty good right now. There's not a lot that I would give up to get something even more. Like, as I think about, you know, investments, like short-term loss in order to get to a long-term gain, I'm like, I don't know what losses I would be willing to incur, because I don't know that there's much more gain that I'm like, I really would want that other thing.
It almost seems like you would have wanted it before you met your wife.
Yes. I think if I was 20 or 21 and single, that's a great job. At the point where I was, it was not as attractive.
Yeah. And there's that whole, we're both fortunate. You're quite young still, don't get me wrong, but we're both fortunate in that we've been able to figure out ways to create jobs for ourselves. Not everybody can do that. I have friends in their 40s, 50s, even 60s who are still working, and it gets harder to find a job as you get older. They don't want you. They don't want, you know, it's illegal to not hire, right? If you say, right. Well, I'm not going to hire that 60-year-old crone, that old hack, that's illegal.
But it happens.
But if you say they weren't qualified or their salary needs were such, or, you know, but the truth is we'd rather get two people who just need pizza money
right. For
the price of one person who's got a family to support.
Yep. And those people that need pizza money will work, you know, they'll work 20 hours a day.
And then they don't know any better. I mean, that's another thing. We have a lot of people who are, and I used to be in advertising, so I know what that's like too. That's the same kind of crazy, right? I think there's less payoff, you know, if you, unless you become the creative director on the Coca-Cola account, you're probably not going to get that rich in advertising, or unless you start right. Your own company and then sell it to Interpublic, you're not going right. To get rich. But they, you know, my joke used to be that every creative director I worked for hated their family. They didn't. But I couldn't understand why we had to work so many hours. And I was always resentful. I was always middle-aged. I was born middle-aged. The good news is I'm past middle-aged now, so now I feel young. But seriously, I was like a middle-aged five-year-old, like going, I failed to see the humor in that remark. Just like stuff that gets you beat up. I just like, that was me. But, you know, I just didn't understand why we had to stay there all night, every night. And weekends. And part of advertising too, they do work on spec all the time.
Yep.
That's how you get, that could be one thing we could kind of wrap with this too. We still pitch accounts in our business, but we don't do it by comping stuff. We don't say we know nothing about your company, but here's three awesome looks.
Right.
Hire us. And we'll throw these out and start over when we have some information. We don't do that. Right. When you pitch, Typically, how do you pitch?
So first, I try not to pitch. You know, that's one is like I do pitch. I write proposals. I go and pitch in person. And I've started to come up with a kind of a rubric for myself as to what I want a pitch to be and what I want it to look like. Very rarely will I get into a situation where Super Friendly is one of 10, you know, that's pitching because right. I don't like those odds.
Right.
I actually just wrote an email this morning to somebody that said, you know, somebody that I've been talking to for the last year, a prospective client I've been talking to for the last year, you know, I've met them for lunch two or three different times and I'm happy to do that kind of stuff and have conversations.
Right. Absolutely. But
I got an email, you know, last week from them that said, hey, we'd love to start on this project. And by the way, we're talking to two other people. And I was like, I'm out. I don't want to do it. You know, I don't
two
even
two others.
Yeah. Two others. I'm like, if you haven't decided at this point, if you don't trust that Super Friendly will do a good job for you at this point, I'm happy to refer you to someone else now. Like, and I know that that's like pompous and kind of arrogant, but I'm like, I want to work with people who know for sure that we're going to do good work with them and that they can trust us to do good work with them. And I tell you, I will work my butt off for that client. Like I will work so hard for them if they trust us to do that. But if it's just sort of like, well, we don't know. And whoever makes us the best, I'm fortunate that I have more leverage in that. I can go work for other clients who are willing to do that. So that's what I try to strive for in proposals. Like, how do I put Super Friendly in a position where clients are clawing down our door to work with us, not the other way around. And that's not to say that there's projects that we want that we wouldn't do a lot of work for. There certainly are. But the way that I try to do that, I just, you know, and I'm in the middle of signing something new this week, where what I did for the pitch was I flew down to the client's office and I just told them a bunch of stories. I put together a deck and I just said, let's talk about, let me show you some past work. Let me show you what we've done for clients in the past. We haven't solved your particular problem before, but let me tell you some stories about how we would do it and how we'd want to work together and how I'd want to work with your team and the team of people that I'm putting together who are going to do a great job for you. Like, let us pitch on capabilities and history, not, you know, yeah, let me do some designs for you. Let me just take some wild guesses and then hope that you will, you know, that you like them. And then we can do the project, because it just starts the project off on the wrong foot.
Now, your studio is a collective, a loosely organized collective where you pick the right team for the right project. And I'm doing something similar. Have you?
I learned it from you.
Well, right. I did it. That was the original Happy Cog.
Yeah. That was my first freelance gig. So we're with you.
Well, and now I'm doing it, and people say, oh, you're doing that Dan Moll thing. And I'm going, yeah, yes, I am.
That's funny.
But do you ever get turned down just because you're not big enough? You're perceived as not big enough? Because they want the security Do you ever hear from clients who like you, they've heard so much about you, they really want to work with you, but then when it gets time to sort of, you know, pull the trigger, they're like, we kind of want somebody who's got $10 million in insurance just in case something goes wrong. You ever have that?
Not anymore. I used to. So the first like 2 or 3 years of Superfriendly have been that. But what has really helped that is, one, now I know all the objections, so I'm prepared for them, right? So I can talk about that. And then the other thing is that I have proof. So they go, but can you do a big project? And I go, sure. TechCrunch, Entertainment Weekly. Like, I can rattle off a list of clients that did, you know, that like, sure, if it worked for them, why wouldn't it work for you? You know? And so I have that at the ready. And then the other thing is, one, I do have all that stuff. So you want $10 million of insurance? Sure, I got that. You know, I've got all the logistics figured out too. And then a lot of the objection that I get is on team. Well, you're collaborative. And so what happens if somebody decides to bail because they're not on staff? And I said, Right. Well, think about what would happen if that other agency you're trying to hire, if somebody bailed from their team. Well, what they would do is they would replace them. Right. And so one, I would do the same thing. I would just replace them because that's my problem and not yours. And the other thing is, I bet you they can't name the team right now. I'll tell you who's going to be on your team right now. And not only are they the people who are going to be really great at this, they are the people who would teach the people that at that other agency that is pitching how to do that work.
Right, right, right.
And clients go, oh, good answer. So I'm prepared for the objections now.
That is all a very good answer. This has been a really wonderful show. I want to thank you for giving us an hour of your time today, and love to have you on again. It's Dan Mall, and you can find him at danmall.me. That is the place to learn about everything Dan Mall. Dan, thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Always good to talk to you.
You too. Take care.